Hello one and all. Welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region, which I've reviewed in the Hürriyet Daily News. You can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher, or you can follow via the Facebook page or my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, and in that way you can make sure that you don't miss an episode. If you're a fan of the podcast and you want to support independent podcasting, you can do so via my Patreon account, making a monetary donation, small or large, on a per episode basis. Find details on all the Turkey Book Talk pages or on my website. But now let's get going with the show. And in this episode, I speak to Bilge Yeşil, who's the author of a new book, Media in New Turkey, The Origins of an Authoritarian Neoliberal State, which is published by the University of Illinois Press. The closure of dozens of outlets and the detention of many journalists accused of links to the Gülen movement following the recent attempted military coup has once again turned the spotlight on Turkey's media. But problems in the Turkish press are nothing new. Bilge Yeşil's book traces the roots of the question back to the 1980s, when the economic structure of the current media system took shape. I started by asking her why that era is so important for understanding today's media landscape in Turkey.
That's a very good question, because let me just quickly say a few things about why I wanted to, you know, like trace what is happening at present time back to the 1980s, because especially after the Gezi protests and the corruption scandal, I was really frustrated seeing, you know, like the Western narratives, media narratives, and, you know, like policy reports that focused on Erdogan as becoming more authoritarian, you know, like imprisoning journalists. So one of the things that compelled me to go back to the 1980s was to show the changes and the continuities and how these problems with, say, the Turkish press or, you know, like Turkish media and whatnot became more pronounced during the AKP era. So anyways, going back to your question, yes, 1980s is really important because it sets the stage for the new commercialized media environment to come. Not only for the commercialized media environment, but also its political and economic relationships, or rather alliances with the government and state institutions and the military. So I think the military coup is an important turning point in 1980, because it sets the stage for all the, you know, like the legal pressures to be used throughout the 1980s and, you know, like 2000s up to present time. All the legal pressures that can be found in the press law, the anti-terror law that comes much later in the 1990s, but, you know, like the penal code, even the constitution. So even when you have these, you know, blanket pronouncements as, you know, like the press is free, etc., but there is this exception. Nobody can, you know, like threaten the unity of the state and things like that. So I think number one is how the military coup set the stage for the legally restrictive environment, if you like. And that we have seen, and that materializes in the imprisonment and persecution of journalists and, you know, like the closing down of magazines, television channels. I was just looking at my Twitter feed, you know, like trying to catch up with the number of TV channels and magazines and radio stations that have been shut down. And, you know, like these all go back to, again, the 1980 constitution, penal code, press law, and whatnot. So that's number one. Number two is, again, in the 1980s, with the introduction of the new economic model, right, where market principles become the most important principles to be followed, both by the state and by private enterprise. That's also the time when business tycoons, these up-and-coming businessmen, Aydın Doğan is one of them, to give a prominent example, these up-and-coming businessmen start, you know, like getting into or dabbling in the media industries. That's when they start buying newspapers. And then in the 1990s, with commercial television channels, they get into the TV business. And as I note in the book, this is, you know, this commercialization and conglomeration of press and television and the blurring boundaries between, you know, newspaper ownership and TV ownership is not necessarily a Turkish phenomenon. We see this in several different media systems around the globe, from those in the West to those in, you know, like Asia and elsewhere. But with the broader dynamics of globalization and neoliberalization in the 1980s, this is, you know, like obviously taking place in Turkey as well. And when combined with the legal pressures that I mentioned, as a result of the 1980 constitution, the, you know, like revisions in penal code and press law and whatnot, we see this immense pressure to turn a profit by media corporations, by media companies. And that takes us to, you know, like sensationalized and entertainment-oriented content, and especially 1990s, you know, like with the first commercial TV channels, and also the tabloidization in the press in the 1980s. But although Turkey is not alone in this respect, we see how business tycoons, you know, like entering media in the 1980s and 1990s, try to use this as what I and other, you know, like media scholars call, you know, like bargaining chips. So they try to use their newspapers and their television channels to extract certain favors from the government, right? And in 1980s, 1990s, these are usually the coalition governments, or to establish certain alliances with the military or with the high state bureaucrats in terms of, you know, like providing positive coverage or suppressing certain, you know, like critical reporting. So I think that kind of a political economic relationship, the establishment of patron-client relationship is a turning point in Turkish media, because this clientelism is also about the tycoons, the media owners or the media bosses are not just trying to extract favors from the government in terms of, you know, like privatization deals or getting the state bids or getting favorable, you know, like bank credits from state banks, but they are also in terms of managing the information flow. They become, you know, like powerful players. So I think those are the two very important turning points in the history of Turkish media. And I also want to make one point. When I say Turkish media, it's completely for reasons of brevity. I do not simply mean, you know, like Turkish. And I'm as you've read the book, you know that I also talk about, you know, like Kurdish or pro-Kurdish newspapers. So for reasons of brevity in the English language, throughout the book, I didn't always. It was more challenging to say, you know, like Turkey-based media or Turkey media or media institutions in Turkey. So when I say Turkish media, I want listeners to understand that it's for purposes of brevity.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned, I mean, the 1980s were what was remarkable. It's easy to forget now from, you know, 30 years on. But before there was the coup in 1980 and before there was this commercialization of the media sector, particularly in broadcasting, it was basically a state monopoly. And what happened when it opened up in the 1980s was that it became a lot cheaper for a lot of reasons to for people to buy media outlets. Could you just go through some of the reasons why? I mean, there were technological changes, market changes that meant that it was...
Yes.
Fairly accessible for tycoons looking to curry favor with the government and win contracts from Ankara. And it just so happened that at that time it was possible to buy outlets because it was relatively cheap.
Exactly. And, you know, I also want to make clear that, you know, it doesn't mean that before 1980, the Turkish press was, you know, like everything was fine. And, you know, like there were no issues in terms of censorship or political economic alliances with the government. No, you know, like if you look at the history of Turkish press, you know, like from 1950s onwards throughout the 60s, 70s, you see, you know, like how each newspaper is, you know, like openly aligned with certain political parties. Right. So that kind of politicization has a long history, even before 1980s. But what happened in the 1980s, I'm sorry, before 1980s, this is what's referred to as journalists or families in Turkey, right? Or these families that have prominent members of the family running the newspaper, managing the newspaper, who have some sort of professional background in journalism themselves. So these were like the press families, right? But as you mentioned, with 1980s, the business tycoons start buying these financially troubled newspapers. They are financially troubled because after 1980s, with the neoliberalization of the economy, the prime minister at the time, Turgut Özal, has, you know, like, and his government imposed certain tariffs and quotas on, you know, like newsprint. And that made it much more difficult in terms of, you know, like their financial ability to cover the increasing costs for these press families, because they had no other business interests. So imagine you're the owner of a newspaper, right? You come from a family who's been always in professional journalism, and that's your only means of revenue. You have no other source of income to run this business. You rely on, I don't know, subscription or newspaper sales, etc. And the newspaper, the newsprint prices go up because of this new economic quotas and tariffs and whatnot. So Özal's decisions, I think, you know, like, and some of the journalists that I talked to, and this is also, you know, like, you can come across this in many, you know, like, history of Turkish press books, that Özal used this as a stick to strong arm certain press families. But what happened was that these economic decisions certainly took a toll on these press families. A lot of them could not, you know, like, survive. So that's why they had to sell their newspapers on the cheap. That's one reason. Another economic difficulty was also introduced by, again, as you mentioned, the technological changes taking place in, you know, like, 80s, late 80s. That is the shift from traditional, you know, like, printing press technologies to, you know, like, computer-assisted technologies or computerized printing and, you know, like, all these new technologies. So this also introduced a new cost item for the newspaper owners. And again, as I said before, if you don't have any other, you know, like, business revenue, on one hand, the newsprint cost is increasing. You have to purchase these, I don't know, new equipments and whatnot. And at the same time, these new distribution monopolies are emerging, right? If you're not part of, like, a big group, you are excluded from this distribution network or monopoly. So that introduces new costs. So journalism becomes more and more costly for these press families. I think that's, again, another important point. The business tycoons come in and they just buy these newspapers on the cheap and enter the business.
You talk about this kind of sensationalization that that happened in the 1980s as well. And it was also, of course, the 1980s was the era when one of the more depressing aspects of the Turkish media landscape really went into overdrive. And that is this huge growth in the number of columnists at the expense of proper reporters. And, you know, today we're very familiar with this in the Turkish media. You know, it's just this great cacophony of columnists offering kind of superficial, sensational opinion and very little investigative stuff out there.
Yes, again, you know, 1980s, I think late 1980s and then early 1990s, especially with the introduction of commercial television, this really became a more pronounced problem. If you look at, I don't know, 60s or 70s newspapers in Turkey, you would still see a lot of, you know, like, opinion and demagoguery and whatnot, but not that much, you know, like, sensational or entertainment-oriented I cannot even call it reporting, but entertainment-oriented coverage or stories. And with the 80s, I think the shift from a closed, protectionist, statist economic model to a market-oriented neoliberal economic structure also played a role in the introduction of this lifestyle, the dominance of lifestyle issues in the newspapers, right? And we see that in the 1980s. And again, this becomes more, you know, pronounced in the 1990s. And of course, as you said today, so you see, you know, like, columnists, we cannot even, you know, like, call them journalists, but, you know, like, again, this is not a specifically Turkish phenomenon or a problem. We see this pretty much in all other, you know, like, press systems around the world. But I think, you know, the rapid proliferation of this kind of, again, in quotation marks, journalism, for lack of a better word, that rapid commercialization, I think that makes it a problematic, again, turning point. So you have this, you know, like, all these converging factors, and I think the rapid turn to lifestyle coverage, entertainment, and these, you know, like, all these fluff pieces and whatnot, and this rapid tabloidization that's happening in the mid to late 1980s, again, that's, like, one of the dynamics that have shaped Turkish media to this day.
I guess, you know, lifestyle, this kind of lifestyle stuff is not bad in itself. You know, it's no. The same everywhere. But the problem is that, you know, in Turkey, it always seems to me that it's kind of filling the space that people mm-hmm. people think it's proper journalism, and it's filling mm-hmm. the space and taking the money of, exactly. you know, what could be, you know, proper reporting.
Exactly. I'm not at all suggesting that there's anything wrong with lifestyle journalism. I mean, you know, like, I enjoy my, I don't know, Kelebek magazine or, you know, like People magazine every now and then, right? But like you said, I think how much of a space and attention, right? Readers and audiences' attention it takes, and how much investigative reporting is done. That's important, right? I mean, in Turkey, there is really still no, like, we don't have like a reference newspaper, right? As say, for example, the New York Times, which is not to suggest that, you know, like New York Times journalism is, you know, like 100% perfect, not at all. But when, you know, like one newspaper after another becomes, you know, like a replica in terms of their, you know, like page layouts and the columnists they employ and the issues they cover. And on top of that, the financial and legal restrictions that are imposed on a few remaining investigative reporters and newspapers, right? That's, I think, that's the problem that that I'm talking about.
Yeah, and that's definitely part of the same dynamic, because the reason mm-hmm. why I think the space for real reporting has narrowed and the space for columnists has opened up more and more is because, mm-hmm. you know, there is a price for proper reporting. I mean, it mm-hmm. seems to me like, I don't know, whenever a famous columnist gets fired, it always makes a lot of headlines and mm-hmm. and people mm-hmm. start to worry again about freedom of the press and mm-hmm. In Turkey. But like far more damaging, it seems to me, is this kind of systematic undermining of proper reporting.
Exactly.
You know, these unspoken red lines that ordinary mm-hmm. journalists can't cross, and the mm-hmm. kind of the filling of their space by rather superficial op-ed writing.
Exactly. And then, you know, like you see these op-ed writers, right, easily make the transition to, say, sister television channels. And then again, it's kind of like this circular thing. So, you know, like with the exception of a few, right? You look at these columns, they're not necessarily based on, you know, like information or, you know, like critical reporting. And basically just, you know, like opinions and sometimes demagoguery, right? And sometimes personal disputes, right? And then you see that columnists move on to the sister television channel and you see them, you know, like on these political shows and whatnot. And before you know it, you know, like that person establishes himself or herself, and it's mostly a he, as a political commentator, as an expert. So that's, I think, another problem among several other problems.
I don't know, if I was in Erdogan's place with these, you know, the powers granted by the state of emergency laws, I think I'd probably use them to fire all the columnists in Turkey and, you know, come to real reporting. But I think that we've kind of slammed the whole institution of columnists enough. But what I want to do is kind of move on now to the AKP era that mm-hmm. we're in. And mm-hmm. One of the things that the book does is it compares the current era with the 1990s. And the way that you describe the 1990s, you know, there is a kind of neat contrast that we can draw, because in the 90s, you know, media bosses were very much under the sway of the generals. You know, they had a direct line to people in the military, and they knew the red lines that they couldn't cross there. And today there's a kind of a shift. Obviously, we're talking just after a military coup, so obviously there's mm-hmm. that's in flux at the moment. But mm-hmm. in general, you know, the military is the media is under the thumb of the AKP regime, and mm-hmm. there's new red lines that they can't cross.
Definitely. And those red lines, interestingly, keep shifting, not obviously on a weekly or a monthly basis, but if you look at the long-term developments, I mean, at least since, you know, like 2007, that's another turning point that I see in, you know, like AKP's relationships with the media, 2007-2008. The media back then, you know, like knew that, I don't know, certain corruption stories or bribery scandals were not to be covered, or at least they learned that after the huge tax fines imposed on Doğan Media, right? And then during the Ergenekon and Balyoz trials, the media learned that the other red line was, you know, had to do with military and their relationships with Gülen. So that, and then after 2013, you know, like with Gezi Park protests, new red lines emerged. After the corruption scandal, new red lines emerged. And, you know, like now with the coup, these enemies and friends of the government, right, depending on the political economic conjuncture and developments, right, as the friends and enemies shift, so do the red lines shift for the media. So in that sense, you know, like I'm quite astounded at their ability to adapt, really. especially if you look at, again, you know, like some columnists, right? People always pull up these past columns, say, you know, like, I don't know, penned by, say, Cengiz Çandar or Hasan Cemal and, you know, or, I don't know, Ekrem Dumanlı. And today I've seen several examples of columns by Mümtaz Ertürkone, right? Mm. They wrote this back in year X, and look what they're writing now, right? And it's not just, again, about the columnists, you know, shifting their alliances, but also whole media groups shifting their alliances. And I think the most prominent example that I can think of right now is how Zaman newspaper changed its editorial line practically the day after December 16th or 17th in 2013 as the corruption scandal erupted. So overnight, you can see how a media conglomeration or a media boss can turn into the enemy of the government or can, you know, become friends.
And that's also, of course, related to this picture that you describe, earlier, the way that economically the media sector is structured, where you have, most of the big media companies don't make much money from, mm-hmm. particularly the newspapers, and they're almost, I think of them as a kind of tax that they feel they have to pay. You know,
yes.
they pay their dues in order to, you know, curry favor with the government. And when they do that, that means that the government is then going to repay them by giving them contracts. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many examples of course, there are these huge infrastructure projects across the country, which these media owners are also bidding for. So it does create this kind of extremely incestuous relationship with the government.
Exactly. And, you know, again, this is not specifically a problem that can be imputed to the AKP government. As I show in the book, this has been, you know, like the case pretty much since, you know, like late 1980s, right? And as you've said, we cannot think of Turkish media companies as, you know, like business operations. They are rather, you know, like politically infused business operations, for, again, lack of a better term. But, you know, like in our field in media studies, this phenomena is referred to as, you know, like media companies being operated as loss leaders, right? So they are not, you know, like we cannot look at them in terms of their, you know, like profits or in terms of, you know, like their investigative reporting or their critical reporting or in terms, we cannot really assess them in terms of the quality of their journalism. And as you said, this, you know, like this relationship with the government, both to extract favors from the government, but also during the AKP era, and this is I think kind of a novel development, to do favors for the AKP. That is quite an interesting development, and I think the best illustration of that comes from these wiretapped conversations that we listened to. I think it was the sale of Sabah newspaper in 2013, if I remember correctly. And that's when, you know, pro-Erdogan businessmen stepped in and they said, you know, like, okay, you know, like we're going to lose a lot of money, but we have to do this, right? We have to create this pool, right? And then we have this new terminology, the pool media, right? So let's create a pool of money, gather our sources together. So, you know, like we can buy this newspaper, therefore it will remain in our hands, right? Meaning, you know, like pro-government, pro-Erdogan businessman's hands. So that's the most recent example I can think of.
Now, we've painted a pretty depressing mm-hmm. picture of the mainstream media, but what about any kind of green shoots of hope because you mentioned there, you know, the Gezi Park protests, which in themselves maybe weren't that important, but what happened afterwards was that they inspired a lot of different initiatives. And obviously summer 2013 seems like a very, very long time ago now, and a lot's changed, but they did inspire, you know, people were brought together, and since then various kinds of original initiatives have been flourishing, really, in digital media particularly. Could you just give us some examples of some of these green shoots? You know, what do you think their prospects are? What are the challenges they face?
Yes, definitely. I mean, to begin with, the citizen journalism sites, I see them as, you know, like very valuable in terms of their, you know, like efforts to at least, you know, like objectively report as much as possible, and to provide some, you know, like critical insights into political and economic developments and whatnot. Obviously, 140 Journos is one of them, is perhaps the first amongst several to come. Then there is there's 98 Haber, and there were a few others that, you know, jumped into citizen journalism after Gezi protests, but they did not, you know, like survive, or did not, you know, like gather a big following. But I think 140 Journos, 98 Haber are really important initiatives. And 98 Haber is also, you know, like doing something very important. And they also have an English version, right, to reach out to international audiences or to English speaking audiences to inform them about, you know, like what's happening in Turkey. And they are also running a lot of 98 Haber is, I think it's headed by Gökhan Biçici, if I'm not mistaken. But they're also running a lot of workshops around the country. And I think so is 140 Journos, especially about, you know, like how citizens can use, you know, like Twitter. But 98 Haber is, you know, like running all these workshops to train people in terms of, you know, like reporting from the ground up. And I think this is, you know, like, in the long run, this could make this is one of those things that's giving me hope, right? Of course, citizen journalism has its own, you know, like limitations as well as possibilities, and it's also important to, you know, like look at to keep in mind that 140 Journos or 98 Haber or other, you know, like similar initiatives, many small initiatives, may, you know, describe themselves in different terms, not as always, you know, like journalists or citizens. So I think there is still, you know, like grappling with issues of, you know, like objectivity of reporting. And I don't see anything, you know, like problematic about this, because, you know, like this is something that's still, you know, like in the development phase, if you like. Maybe, you know, like 10 years later, 20 years later, we're going to look back at, you know, like 2013, 14, 15 and see and say, you know, like, oh, this is how citizen journalism initiative started. And, you know, like within 2 or 3 years, you know, like they faced several problems, but then this is how they developed. So we're still going through it. So it's kind of like difficult for us to sidestep and come up with a definite conclusion. But I definitely see a lot of value in these initiatives. I like to call them, you know, like information activists. So there is this great hunger, this yearning for information as well as objective reporting. Now you can say, you know, like there is really no objectivity. What exactly is objective journalism or objective reporting? But all these, you know, like issues with mainstream media in Turkey, especially the lack of, you know, critical reporting, investigative reporting, I think has left us with this yearning for information. And this is the void that these initiatives are trying to fill. Another initiative that really gives me hope is Turkey's first fact-checking initiative, Doğruluk Payı. I think we can translate as a measure of truth. I see a lot of value in what they're doing. And I think these initiatives are going to proliferate. And, you know, like, so you see 140 Journos and 98 Haber trying to introduce new practices of journalism, right? And then you look at Doğruluk Payı, that is all about information. And I think it's born out of a very troubling situation in Turkey that has come to the fore in recent years, and that's the blurring of truth and fiction. From, say, the Kabataş video and all the other problematic, let's say, coverage of, you know, like certain events during and afterwards, Gezi protests. And again, there is this need for what is true, what is not. In a media environment, which is, you know, like very politicized, which is very commercialized, which is very polarized, what happens to truth? How do you define what's true or not? And even, you know, like since 2007, 2008, with Ergenekon trials especially, we've been having this discussion, you know, like who is a journalist? Because we've always heard, oh, they're arrested not because of their journalistic activities. Oh, they're not journalists, you know, like they're hiding behind the cloak of journalism. So I think when all these terms are up in the air, right, who's a journalist? What is truth? What is, you know, like evidence, right? What counts as evidence? And of course, out of that void emerges this kind of, you know, like initiative like Doğruluk Payı. I think they are all, despite the differences in you know, like the arenas that they operate or that they emerge from, they're all concerned with information. And I find, you know, like great value. I see great value in their activism.
That was Bilge Yeşil. You can find a link to my review of her book, Media in New Turkey, at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, where there's also an edited transcript of this interview. You can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate it on iTunes or Stitcher, which helps other people find the show. Or you can like the Facebook page. And just a reminder here that you can also support the podcast via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Andrew Cruikshank, Özlem Beyarslan, Steve Bryant and Aaron Ataman. But meanwhile, until the next episode, thank you very much for listening.